Week Right, CKUT 90.3 Latin Music Mondays, right?
Previously broadcast program.
Good afternoon, and welcome to this week's McGill Alumni Webcast. My name is Derek Kassoff, Managing Director of Communication at McGill's Office of University Advancement. Under normal times, students, medical residents, and those recently graduated from McGill's Faculty of Medicine are able to ease into their chosen professions during their first few years of practice. But the COVID-19 pandemic, which hit Montreal particularly hard this spring, changed those plans for many, pressing medical residents and newly minted nursing and occupational therapy graduates into service on our hospital's COVID wards, where they played a crucial role in helping the city's healthcare institutions handle a surge of coronavirus patients. Today, we'll hear from three women, one medical resident and two recent graduates, who will share with us what it was like to put their own health at risk in service of our community's most vulnerable, and find out how this experience may have shaped their perspective on their roles in delivering healthcare. And what a privilege it is for me to speak to these three remarkable and courageous young women. Let me quickly introduce them. Dr. Annick Béral-Giesson is a third-year resident in anesthesiology who spent a month working in the intensive care unit at the Jewish General Hospital during the height of the city's COVID-19 outbreak. She's also the president of the Association of Residents of McGill. Welcome.
Thanks.
We have Palmina Montanaro, who's a two-time McGill graduate with degrees in pharmacology and nursing. She works full-time at the Jewish General Hospital, most recently in the palliative care wing, but spent several weeks on the hospital's COVID ward. Welcome. And finally, Jacqueline Stevenson, who graduated from McGill a year ago with a degree in occupational therapy and now works at the MUHC, the McGill University Health Center. She too volunteered to be transferred to a COVID ward during the pandemic. Welcome to all three of you, and thank you so much for taking time out of your busy days to share your stories with us today. As a reminder, if you are watching live and have a question for our guests, you can send it in by email to aoc@mcgill.ca. So let's start by getting to know each of you a little bit more. I'm curious to know why each of you decided to pursue a career in healthcare and whether there was anything in particular that motivated you to go into the profession. Maybe we'll start with you, Annick.
Sure. I got in directly from CGIP, actually. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, so I got into medical school because I could. And it's 2 years into my medical school that I decided to take a year off to travel. And then I realized during that year of traveling that medical, like the health profession, was what I really wanted to do. And I was sure I could find something there that I could help out for pretty much anyone that I've met throughout the world is people that I wanted to help.
Great, great, great. How about Palmina? How about you? How did you sort of get on the track to become a nurse?
Sure, yeah. So I always knew I wanted to work in healthcare, partially because it kind of combines my love of biology and physiology, which have always been my favorite subjects in school, just because I love learning about the human body. I find it fascinating. And so combine that with helping people, so that's why I wanted to work in healthcare. And I chose nursing specifically, mostly ultimately because of how much nurses get to be with patients and the sort of care that we get to provide. And my understanding, if you will, of that, of like what the nursing role is, came from conversations I had with two nurses as I was graduating from college and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Just what they described really spoke to me, really appealed to me. And so that's kind of what motivated me to go into nursing, and I've loved it ever since.
Great. And I'm sure you're a lot about your interaction with patients during the COVID pandemic, yeah, and the next time we have together. How about yourself, Jacqueline? Occupational therapist. How did you land on that as a career?
So quite similar to Palmina, I always knew I wanted to do something in health sciences. Again, I loved all my anatomy and physiology classes that I took in CGIP. And I loved working with people. I worked at a summer camp growing up. So I knew I wanted to combine those two, and I knew healthcare was definitely the thing I wanted to do. I actually didn't know much about occupational therapy, probably like many people. When I applied, one of my friend's moms brought up the program, and I thought it sounded interesting. And it was only once I started the program that I actually realized it was a bachelor's and a master's combined. And the more I went forward in the program, the more I fell in love with the profession. Similar to Palmina, I really love the amount of time that we get to spend with patients and getting to work with them every day and seeing them improve. So I think that's really what got me into occupational therapy in the first place.
Great. So I did want to ask you, maybe you could tell us a little bit more, what does an occupational therapist do in the healthcare system?
Sure. So occupational therapists can work in many different areas, rehab centers, hospitals, schools, CLSCs. So really as a broad role, when someone has an illness or injury, we help get people back to the activities that are meaningful to them. So in the hospital specifically, what I do, we have several different roles. So one main role that we have is functional assessments. So we evaluate what we call activities of daily living. So a patient's ability to get dressed, to shower, to drive, to cook. And we'll evaluate physical components. So we'll look at, for example, their strength or their balance. And we also evaluate their cognitive or perceptual abilities through their functional status. And this allows us to make a recommendation to the team of whether we think the patient is safe to go home, if we think they can benefit from more services, for example, for the CLSC, if we think they're a rehab candidate and have the potential to improve, or if we think they need relocation to a residence or a long-term care. So we'll work closely with the multidisciplinary team to get this patient back to their functional baseline, what we call. And another role that we have in this hospital is performing swallowing evaluations. So we'll assess a patient's safety to eat by mouth and recommend certain consistencies that we feel are safe for them to eat. And we also want to optimize their independence to feed. And finally, we have a few other scattered different roles, such as making positioning recommendations, doing driving screen evaluations, and working with people with hand difficulties and splints.
Wow, sounds like you've got a lot on your plate with the patients that you work with. But thanks for enlightening all of us with that. Do any of you come from families of doctors, nurses, or therapists?
I mean, I had my grandfather who was a doctor, but apart from that, no one else.
Right.
My great uncle was an ophthalmologist in Boston, so he kind of inspired me to get into the sciences from a young age, but other than that, not really.
Okay. So what were your family's reactions when you told them that you were pursuing a career in medicine and healthcare? They must have been proud of you, I imagine.
Yeah, I think I'm lucky to have a really supportive family. I think, you know, and I'm hopeful that whatever career choice I would have chosen, they would have been supportive. But I think the pandemic was maybe the first time, though, that they were maybe thought that I should have chosen something else or wanted me to choose something else than a healthcare career.
Yeah, great. And we'll talk about that in a minute for sure. So let's set the stage for our viewers. Obviously, none of you were working with infectious diseased patients at the beginning of this year. So I'm curious, what were each of you doing at the beginning of March? And what happened at each of your hospitals when it became more and more obvious that you needed to prepare to receive patients with COVID-19? We'll start, and I think we actually have a few pictures that you've all shared with us ahead of time that we'll display on the screen as you tell us a little bit about your stories. We'll start with Anika and Palmina. I believe at the Jewish General Hospital, that was actually one of the first in the city to be designated as a COVID center. So when did each of you first learn that there was a possibility that you might be assigned to or asked to volunteer for a role with COVID patients? Anika, let's start with you on that.
Sure. So I was actually at the Montreal General Hospital during in the operating room when I first heard that this COVID thing was happening, and I wasn't sure what was going to happen afterwards. But from day to day, they started shutting down operating rooms. They started turning around patients to go back home if you weren't like a pressing operation to get. They started building those anti-chambers in front of the operating rooms to try to create negative pressure rooms around the operating room who are all positive pressure rooms. So it was all like this construction going on, like plastic being put up all the way everywhere, not knowing what to do with everyone, like the panic from the beginning. That's what really like I remember mostly from my beginning there. After a couple of weeks, I gotta say, we got used to it a bit more. I mean, it's still a lot to think of every time you go into an operating room, because that's where I mostly work, in the operating room. But then eventually, the PGME office, so the Postgrad Medical Education Office from McGill, started putting residents a bit in the COVID wards in the ICU, depending on where they needed residents and people for medical support, basically. Some residents were also asked to volunteer if they wanted to. So I volunteered to go to the Jewish General Hospital in their intensive care unit. I figured I had to go to the intensive care, so I figured why not now and learn a lot about COVID, which it's all a new disease, so no one really knows anything about it. So it was a volunteer thing.
Wow, okay. How about yourself, Pamina? So you, I believe, are working in the palliative care unit at the Jewish General. So did someone just sort of tap you on the shoulder one day and ask you to move somewhere else, or were they looking for volunteers? How did that work for you?
So March, the beginning of March, it had just been 3 months. I was still getting acquainted with palliative care, which was a new position that I started in January. And essentially what happened was the ward that I was working on before palliative care got converted to a COVID ward at the end of March. And because I had worked there before, I was kind of like the prime, I keep saying prime suspect, or that's not the right word, but to kind of, you know, be asked to go back. And so I remember it was like March 26th or 27th that I got a call. I was at home doing like an at-home workout, and I got a call from my head nurse asking if I wanted to go back. And then I had a lot of hesitation about it, but ultimately agreed, kind of, I think similar to what Anik shared. I wanted to, you know, it seemed like the perfect scenario to help, kind of where it was going to be a unit that I was familiar with colleagues that I knew. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to go there before I got transferred somewhere else, kind of that I less wanted to be with, wanted to be. And in terms of what happened in the Jewish, kind of like as more and more people infected with COVID had to be hospitalized, we started opening up more and more floors designated for COVID, and kind of they would transfer the patients that were on those floors to other units, or they would continue to receive their care. And then those units would get prepared to receive like exclusively COVID patients, and kind of slowly, as you know, the pandemic or things grew in Montreal, more and more floors would do that. And I think in the end, we ended up having like 7 floors designated to COVID, and super thankfully now they've mostly all closed, I think, except for 1 or 2. Because there's less and less COVID patients. And I think that one of the pictures, I guess, that now you put up our pictures, was when we became a hot zone. And essentially we had to wear PPE for the whole shift at one point, and that was hot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do want to ask you guys in a minute about what it was like working in that situation. But one other question I wanted to ask you about, Pamina, was your living situation. I know when we spoke by phone earlier in the week, you said that part of your transition to the COVID ward meant that you had to move out of your parents' home. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that decision?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so kind of early on, when things kind of exploded mid-March, I was still working part-time palliative care at that time, and I felt a little bit guilty and kind of really wanting to help out more, because given that I was working part-time, I was working like, you know, a couple of days a week. I wanted to do more to help with, you know, my nursing colleagues who are working really hard on the front lines. But because I live with my family, and especially my parents, who kind of, you know, are at risk of getting really sick when they get COVID, I decided that I would stay in palliative care, and like that's how I would contribute to things. But then when I got the call from my head nurse, my big hesitation was the fact that I live with my parents. But that weekend, I started contacting my old colleagues who were working on the COVID ward to ask what it was like. And then one of them super, super generously offered that she had a spare bedroom that I could stay in, you know, if living with my parents was like the reason I couldn't come back to help. And so because I wanted to help, because she made this offer, I decided to, you know, I agreed to it. So, and then the week after was a pretty big week. I remember like the Tuesday I accepted to help. The Wednesday I got my schedule. The Thursday I did a training, moved out, and I started the Friday. So yeah.
Wow. But, in a new apartment. So that's quite
exactly,
a
yeah.
sacrifice.
But
wow.
I do want to mention though that I think, you know, I wasn't the only one who decided to do that. Like there were a lot of my colleagues who decided to move away from their kids and their partners and ended up living in hotel rooms for the time that we were working with COVID patients. So
wow.
I was definitely not the only one to do something.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. How about you, Jacqueline, in your case at the MUHC, which I think initially was not actually designated as a COVID hospital earlier in the outbreak. So how did it work at your hospital, and specifically with occupational therapists? Were there sort of groups at you that were sort of selected to work with the COVID patients, and what kind of decision was it for you to make to agree to do that?
Yeah, so for us at the MUHC, we weren't one of the first hospitals with COVID patients. So we began to hold the MUHC was holding town halls every week to update us on what was happening with the COVID-19 situation. And so I remember hearing that the Jewish was going to start receiving patients. And we were told we were phase three. So I think the Jewish was phase one, and then Sacré-Cœur and Maison de Rosemont would be phase two. And then we were part of the third phase with the Chum. And it didn't take too long after, however, that we were told we were going to be activated as a COVID center. And so kind of similarly to Palmina as well, the unit that I currently work on is internal medicine. And that was going to be one of the first units that was going to slowly start to convert into a COVID unit. So I remember the first few days after we found that out, they started taking our non-COVID internal medicine patients and sending them elsewhere in the hospital. They were doing a complete reorganization. And so for many members of our multidisciplinary team, like the physiotherapist and the dietitian and social worker and liaison nurse that I work with, we weren't sure what we should do, if we should follow the patients we've usually been following or if we should be staying on that floor. And I have to say, I work with such an amazing multidisciplinary team. And we kind of all discussed it and thought that we'd each volunteer to our managers to work on that unit and stay on that specific unit because we felt like we were a strong team and we'd be able to support each other. As well, I also live with my best friend who's a nurse at the MUHC as well. So I kind of felt like, as opposed to some of my colleagues who live with their parents or other people that could have been at higher risk, I felt like I was in a good position to step up. And then I'll also add that as there were more and more COVID units in our hospital, we ended up having almost half of our occupational therapy department that was designated to work on the COVID units because they were quite busy. And my manager even had brought in extra occupational therapists because the demand was so high for both for us working on the COVID side and on the non-COVID side.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this, Jacqueline, the night before your first shift with COVID patients, were you scared?
I remember being a little nervous, more because I was doing the groceries for my grandparents and I was super stressed about passing anything on to them, even though I was always being very careful. So I remember being nervous about that. However, the day I got there, it kind of felt normal. You know, we were stricter with our donning and doffing procedures. But really, once I got into the rooms, I didn't really see the COVID. I was seeing kind of the same type of patients that I usually work with. So I think it was almost, I don't remember being that worried about actually working with COVID patients. And I had all the nurses I work with on my floor and the multidisciplinary team are so supportive. So that was very comforting for sure.
Right. How about you, Anique? Were you scared the night before your first shift?
No, I wasn't. I was mostly annoyed by all the PPE we had to put on, but I wasn't scared. We had so much practice with mannequins and looking at each other. You never do this alone anyway, so there's not no risk, but like you're as safe as you can be. That's how I saw
it. Right. Okay. I actually was going to ask you guys about how the hospitals trained you to work on these wards, specifically wearing all the PPE. Can you tell us a bit about that, Anique? Like how did the training and the preparation go for you guys, the medical residents?
So I think it depended on which hospital you were at. They put a lot of PowerPoint presentations on how to don, how to doff, etc. At the beginning, no one knew exactly what type of PPE you had to put on in what type of situation. So that was the harder part, to decide which one when. But after they kind of settled on something, then we would all practice on mannequins. So they would give you the equipment, get you to go see a mannequin as a patient, and then you don, go see the patient, come out, and the doffing, which is the most important part, like do it properly without contaminating yourself. And if you do, then you restart again and again and again until you actually get it down.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Palmina? Was it a similar sort of training for you as a nurse?
I was a bit different in that, we had like a 2-hour. So before everything happened, we had like these mini trainings. We had to get our N95s fitted, and we had to like watch these videos about putting on personal protective equipment. But then when I agreed to transfer to the COVID ward, there was like a 2-hour training that mostly involved the how to put on and take off your PPE, because there's a specific order that you have to do it in to keep yourself safe. And within that training, it also included kind of how to take samples from patients, so whether it be like blood or a COVID sample, and how to decontaminate it properly so that when we sent it to the lab, it wouldn't, there wouldn't be a risk of contaminating the lab technician.
Great, great. Thank you. So let's, I'd like to hear a little bit more about what it was like for each of you actually working on the wards with COVID-19 patients in your hospitals. So Anik, maybe I'll turn it back to you. As a third year resident, I imagine you've been exposed to a lot of different hospital settings in your career. Things like the joy and excitement of obstetrics and perhaps the frantic rush of an emergency room. How did the ICU unit during COVID-19 compare with those experiences?
So I've done multiple ICU rotations before COVID and during COVID, and the experience was quite different. By the time I got there to the ICU, people were more used to it. They were kind of getting into the groove of having the PPE all the time. But what I gotta say that was the worst part was probably the sadness of it all. A lot of people dying and they can't be with their family, and you speak to the families every day and their main request is, can I come and see them? Can I come and see them? And yeah, we do FaceTime, we do all those things with the families of the patient, but it's never the same thing as actually being able to go in. So it's a lot less people on the floor. And it's the family part that I find very sad, because even those chronic patients who are there, they know that they can't see their family and they know that they're not doing well. And you try to get them, the family, to come in the last 24, 48 hours, but it's so difficult on an ICU ward to know, like, oh, yes, this is the last 24 hour of life of this person. It's almost impossible to know. So it was really the sadness, and that's what mostly got to me during the COVID thing.
Right. Now, what about, Anik, just to stick with you for a minute, I know you said you're working mainly in operating rooms. What was the communications like amongst physicians? I imagine things would have been different protocols when you're sort of dressed up essentially like space aliens. So how did protocols change around operating procedures?
Yeah, so it's with a mask and all this equipment, you gotta, like, you have a mask and then another visor on top of it. You can't read people's lips. You can barely see their eyes and all this PPE equipment. It's so difficult to understand one another. And I've seen this in the operating room and also in the ICU when we get any kind of procedures. We need to, like, get together before getting into the operating room. So everyone, so the surgeons, the anesthesiologists, the nurses, we use a lot of respiratory therapists as well. So all these people need to get together before the operating room and go through what they're going to do. Plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, plan all of your different plans that you could possibly want. You can't go in and out of the room. You're stuck in that room. So everything needs to be in there. And then you say, I'm going to do this. If this doesn't work, I'm going to go do this. If this doesn't work, then I'm going to go do this. Because communication is almost impossible in all that PPE equipment. So it's very difficult. So it's a lot more planning. And even after you came out of the operating room or whatever procedure room you were doing, we had a lot of debriefing as well. Oh, okay, like, we didn't think of this. Next time we have to think of that. So to try to, like, ameliorate the process every single time.
Right. How about you, Palmina, when you think back to sort of the various experiences you've had in nursing in your very still young career, how did this one, working with COVID patients, compare to some of your other experiences?
Yeah, I think what was really different about the COVID, my time on the COVID ward was kind of how much things changed over the 2 months that I was there. Kind of, you know, like when, you know, I would say in palliative care, the patient population that I'm caring for and the way I'm able to nurse and kind of care for patients is pretty, like, it's pretty the same, you know, like obviously things will be different every day, but what was interesting about the time of my COVID ward is things changed a couple of times. And so I can, so essentially at first we were what we called like a cold zone, where we would put on the PPE before going into each patient's room and take it off when we come out of the room. And because, you know, and to limit the amount of times we took off the PPE, we were really like encouraged to limit how many times we physically went into patients' rooms. And what was difficult about that was just that, you know, there was literally this physical barrier between like me and the patient. And so I wasn't able to care for them in the same way that I'm used to and that want, you know, and I wanted to. Like I wasn't able to go in and be with them as much as I wanted to. And that was really difficult, really challenging. And then we transitioned to what was the hot zone, where we were wearing our PPE all the time, you know, within the hallways and the nursing station and as we charted and obviously within patients' rooms. And that was obviously different than anything I've ever done. But Yeah, and so that was really hot. And then we transitioned to like a colder hot zone where the PPE changed a little bit. It wasn't like the N95s, it was surgical masks. And thank goodness we got rid of like the head covering, which was like the white thing in my picture, because that thing was not breathable and very, very hot. And also the patients that we were caring for kind of also changed a couple of times. And it was kind of like before we knew it, they had changed. Like it started with younger adults, like between like 40 and 60, who had traveled and needed hospitalization. And so that time was different because they chose to do what we call a full code. And so it required a lot more monitoring, like a lot more closer monitoring. And then it transitioned into, you know, as they started going home and recovering, it transitioned to a lot of dying patients. And I'm super thankful for that. I had the experience in palliative care to kind of, you know what the dying process looks like, know how to care for dying patients, know how to cope with a patient who passes away, which can be really difficult. And then towards the end, like about the last month of my time on the COVID ward, we were left with the older adults from residences who couldn't return for X, Y, Z. And so that care, like the priorities and the care that we were providing changed to like helping them a lot more with what Jacqueline called before the activities of daily living, some kind of, you know, eating, hygiene, grooming, walking. So I guess that's a long answer to your question of how things are different. Just I think the amount of times things change was different than what I'm used to.
Great. Well, thank you for that answer. Jacqueline, a little surprise for you. We actually just got a couple of questions specifically for you from one of our viewers. So maybe I'll turn it over to that question right now. We'll start with the first one. The questions came in from Pam Cantor. So thank you, Mrs. Cantor, for these questions. The first one for you was, how were you able to offer occupational therapy for COVID-19 patients? And what kinds of treatment targets did you have?
Sure. So I think I'll just start off by saying that our units were instantly full of consults for us as occupational therapists, because all of a sudden we received this huge influx of patients. They were all new. So I think one of the main interventions we were performing was swallowing. So a lot of patients were requiring swallowing assessments either because they had been intubated in the ICU for an extended period of time and then they had been recently extubated, or because they came in with altered mental status, which can sometimes impact swallowing, or because they were coming from places like CHSODs and residences where oftentimes people have baseline swallowing difficulties. So that was one of our main interventions. And then we had a lot of functional assessments to do in terms of really evaluating what the patient was able to do. We were seeing a lot of patients that were very deconditioned, either because they hadn't been mobilized for a long period of time and they were staying in bed, or because the COVID just made them very weak. And so there was a lot of rehab to be done. And we, at the beginning, kind of like Kamina was saying, we had to be very cautious with the PPE. So we really only were trying to go in when absolutely necessary. But then as we were seeing that rehab was very important in allowing these patients to recover and get them back to where they're living or sending them to rehab, we were going in more and more to doing frequent follow-ups and really working with them to get them stronger.
Great. Thank you. The second question from Pam Cantor, she's asking about how high a risk of exposure to COVID were you exposed to? And how would you say that risk of transmission compared to other healthcare providers, such as nurses?
So I think it's kind of hard to say. I know as occupational therapists, we were spending a lot of time kind of similar to nurses. So, you know, a bit more than half my day was probably spent doing interventions with patients in their room. So we were quite exposed in a similar way to nurses. I know we were also on my floor kind of pairing up so that, let's say I was going in to evaluate a patient, I would maybe help change them or help wash them so that a nurse didn't have to go in, and vice versa. So if a nurse was going in, I would maybe observe what they were doing from the door. So we'd kind of work like that. I think swallowing is probably one of the bigger risks of exposure because patients can cough as a sign of aspiration. However, as occupational therapists, we're also not really involved in any of the aerosolizing procedures that would necessarily require an N95 mask. So I think it's some cases, it's very similar to what the nurses are exposed to. And then other cases, maybe sometimes based on a procedure, they might be exposed a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Great. So again, if anyone is watching live and does want to send in a question, the email address again is aoc@mcgill.ca, and we'll try to squeeze in as many as we can before the end of this webcast. So because this is a McGill webcast, I do need to ask this question, which is, how did your training at McGill prepare you for this big moment in your careers? Maybe I'll start with you, Anik. You're still at McGill studying as a resident. So how did the McGill education and McGill training prepare you?
Well, as medical residents, you know that if anything happens at any time, you need to jump in. That's kind of a given. As soon as you take the oath to become a doctor, that's, you kind of make this as well. McGill was very supportive. The one difference with being a resident is that at the same time as being a full-time worker and a full-time doctor, you're also a full-time student. So I still needed to learn, and not just about COVID. So the McGill had to really split all the residents and make sure that all residents would be able to, yes, contribute to society, but at the same time still be able to learn and come out as not a specialist of COVID, but still a specialist in your own specialty. So that was the one difference, but I think they've done a pretty great job in making sure that it's not always the same people that go back onto the COVID wards, and really to make a rotation out of everyone. So I think they've been pretty good for that.
Great. Palmina, you've been out of the Ingram School of Nursing for 3 years now. So when you look back at your time at McGill, how did it prepare you for this moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that definitely, like, I mean, all of my physical assessment skills, or most of them at least, come from my time at McGill. Like, we had a physical assessment class where we kind of learned how to thoroughly assess each body system. And so obviously my ability to do a thorough lung assessment was really needed and useful during this time. And I think that McGill kind of does this nicely kind of combines theory with clinical experience. We had like some clinical practicums within my time there. And so it kind of gives us the opportunity to critically think and, you know, connect the dots and kind of understand why I'm seeing what I'm seeing. And I mean, that's a skill that's helpful, like, in my daily life as a nurse, but I think especially so during the pandemic.
Great. Thank you. And how about yourself, Jacqueline? You've been out of McGill a year now. Yeah. You've had a couple of minutes to think about this question.
Yeah. So I think for me, you know, because occupational therapy is so broad, I find the program at McGill does a really good job of teaching us certain values that we carry forth of the OT profession, no matter what setting we're in. So one of the main takeaways, I think, from that program that many of my fellow students or ex-students would say is that they teach us to be patient-centered. So in a hospital setting, sometimes it's a bit more difficult for the patients to advocate for themselves or to really see what the patient's goals might be, especially with maybe an older population, people coming from sessions of days or residences. And so what I found has really helped me during this time is taking the time to find little things that are meaningful to these patients. For example, I had one patient that he was quite scared to be here. He had hearing difficulties, and, you know, we were having trouble communicating with him. And I had found that just with the time of writing the messages on the board, instantly he was actually able to follow what I was saying. And we no one else had been able to communicate with him before, and it was able to really calm him down. So even just little things, you know, the patients don't have much control. Unfortunately, being isolated in a room, not even being able to walk out of the hallways like they used to be. So just spending the time to find little things that really help make the patient stay a little better.
Great. And I'm glad you mentioned patient-centered, Jacqueline, because I do want to speak a little bit now about your interactions with various patients, specifically on the wards. And maybe I'll stick with you, Jacqueline. I understand that the MUHC actually named you a champion of occupational therapy for a particular episode where you were having trouble communicating with a patient who didn't speak English or French very well. So not to embarrass you anymore, but can you tell us a little bit about that particular case and how you managed to help this patient and his family?
Sure. So for this patient particularly, I was asked to do a swallowing evaluation, and it was quite urgent. The team wanted me to do this as fast as possible. And I had gone into the room and I could not wake the patient up at all. And I couldn't convince the patient to kind of follow anything I was saying. So I went back out of the room and I called the daughters of this patient. And I asked them, you know, is there anything that you think might help to wake up your mother, to convince her to eat with me? And they said that they thought she'd respond really well to them. And so I went back in the room and put them on speakerphone, and instantly the patient woke up. She was speaking with her daughters, and the daughters hadn't had contact with their mother for quite a long time because a lot of new family members were allowed into the CHSODs or residences. And so they began to cry. And it was really quite useful for me because we realized that the patient would eat when the daughters were present on the phone. So I was able to do my evaluation and then pass that message along to the nurses, who were able to get the daughters on the phone when it was time to feed the patient.
Great. Sounds like a great initiative on your part to do that. Palmina, let me ask you. I know when we spoke earlier preparing for this call, you also shared with me some stories about how nurses such as yourself were setting patients up on Skype calls so they could speak with their loved ones. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. The way we kind of kept like families connected to the patient was by phone calls. Like, they would call during the day and kind of ask for updates on how the patient was doing, you know, if they ate, how they were breathing, if they were on oxygen. So we'd kind of update them there. And then the second aspect of keeping them connected would be through the Skype and FaceTime calls that we'd facilitate. Often the patients, unfortunately, wouldn't be able to, like, you know, set up, like, hold the tablet themselves. So we would often be the ones behind the tablet, kind of allowing family and patients interact. And it led to some interesting and sometimes really sad experiences, particularly for the dying patient. So I was holding the tablet and kind of got to witness this, like, really intimate interaction between the family and patient that I otherwise wouldn't have been able to, would have never witnessed, you know, where families would say things like, you know, I miss you, I love you, it's okay, you can let go. And so obviously I'd be behind the tablet kind of sweating and crying, but I'm an easy crier, so but as difficult as those times were, you know, I think that I was really grateful that I was able to give the family that chance to say goodbye. Because although, you know, as Anik shared, they were able to kind of come visit, like, there was a lot of rules around it, but if a patient was imminently dying, they would be able to maybe come visit. But a lot of the patient's family was too old or had other risk factors that made them, you know, not able to come on a COVID ward. So yeah, this was really a way of, like, allowing families to get that in those final moments of the patient.
Wow. How about yourself, Anik? Were there any particular moment or procedure that stands out for you during your time on the COVID ward?
So I unfortunately don't work as closely with patients as Palmina and Jacqueline are able to do. Being a resident, you have multiple patients, so you're only able to be there when the patient really doesn't go well or things like this. But the more day-to-day interaction for sure happens more throughout the nurses and other healthcare professionals like this. So I am able to go see the patients, the families. We talk to them a lot. So it's often us who are going to announce to the family that the patient is dying and that there's nothing much that modern medicine can possibly offer to the patient. So we're often there to give the bad news to the family and then follow throughout, but not as much. In terms of procedures, every time you do what they call an aerosol generating medical procedure, which basically means any kind of intubation, extubation, putting anything basically that requires to go through the mouth, can cause a lot of the virus to come out, basically, and that's how you get infected. And that's when you need to put, like, those N95s and stuff like this. But if you're not doing any kind of those procedures, then you don't need an N95, just the regular old PPE, like we've been showing since the beginning. But being in anesthesia and being in an ICU, I had a lot of medical procedures that generate a lot of high viral load and a lot of chances of contamination through that. So one of the most aerosol generating procedure that we have is, like, a bronchoscopy or an intubation. So bronchoscopy is basically putting a camera inside the lungs of a patient. With this, you can either diagnose something or wash the lungs, make sure that you get, like, all the virus that's in there and all the inflammation, you can get it out, send for cultures and stuff like this that you can have. So I had to do one of those bronchoscopies on a patient who was very, very sick, with a very, very high viral load at that moment. And he was also a rule out of other things that are also in his lungs. So he wasn't just a COVID patient. He was a COVID patient with other things on top, which is also a possibility. Once you get COVID, you can always get more things on top of it. So that was one procedure that I was honestly quite scared when I got out of there. I was like, okay, so there's not just COVID that I could have gotten there. There's also a whole bunch of stuff that I could have gotten from this patient during this procedure. And it's not like a 2-minute procedure. It's a procedure that takes 20, 25 minutes, depending on how long you need to really explore all the lungs of this patient. So that was a particularly scary moment for me, but I'm still happy I was able to help this patient and hopefully take out some of this inflammation he had inside of his lungs just by doing this bronchoscopy.
Wow. Wow. Great stories, all of you. I think I introduced you at the beginning as courageous women, and you're certainly proving me right with all these incredible stories. I'm just curious. I know here in Montreal and elsewhere around the world, we've seen tremendous public displays of support for all of the heroic work taking place in our hospitals and institutions, people lining up to bang pots and pans and police cars driving by with their sirens on and lights flashing. And other than disturbing your precious sleep, I'm wondering, have these spontaneous moments of appreciation, what have they meant to you and your colleagues? Maybe I'll start with you, Jacqueline.
Yeah, sure. I think it's meant a lot. I know that, you know, during this whole pandemic, one of the big things that people are starting to realize is that there's so many different roles in a hospital with so many important people, like, for example, the people who manage all the supplies and equipment, the préposés, house cleaners. There's so many essential roles, and I think it's nice to see that the public is supporting everyone that's working on the front lines and putting themselves out there to help during this time. So I think it's really great.
Great. Palmina, how about yourself?
Yeah. I think that, like, you know, not only all those, like, public shows of affection, I guess, if you will, or just the praise in general has been really interesting. It's left us kind of feeling like celebrities. You know, but I think, like, in general, it's just been really, really humbling and kind of, you know, grateful, kind of like Jacqueline said, that, you know, all healthcare workers are getting recognition for the work that we do.
Great. And how about you, Anik?
Yeah, so I back up totally what the other two said. What I would add on top of it is that I feel like when people think of, like, the medical world, they think of doctors and nurses and they kind of forget everyone else. Mm-hmm. So the fact that this was happening, and, like, we talked a lot about the préposés aux bénéficiaires and, like, the CHSLDs, and as if they were, like, forgotten people in, like, the everyday modern medicine that's happening, and they forget that there's other people who work there, and it's not just doctors and nurses who make up a whole hospital. There's, like, a whole bunch of other people. So being able to, like, show to the public that it's not just us, it's like we're a whole team of, like, a lot of different specialists that come from all different backgrounds to come and help out your loved ones. I think that the public is finally seeing that, and I find that absolutely beautiful.
Great. So maybe one last question for each of you before we wrap up this wonderful discussion, and maybe we'll go in the reverse order. We'll start with you, Anik. I think I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. So the question is, when you reflect back on this experience, which I know is still fresh for many of you, what sort of perspective has this given you around your career choice, your decision to go into medicine? Has it perhaps made you think twice, like, maybe I should have gone to business school or studied law? Or has it reinforced for you the value of your decision, knowing how important your work is to so many people?
100% reinforced the whole thing. 100%. I would not hesitate to say that. I feel like I can see a purpose in what I'm doing more than ever. Not that I didn't before, but, like, with this whole thing happening and seeing the population back up all the healthcare workers, I can 100% say that I'm behind it and would never change.
All right. Palmina?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, totally the second one. I think that this, you know, like, I see every day, and that's what I love about nursing, is, like, it's kind of like, you know, you see kind of right away the difference that I get to make in patients and families' lives. But I think that this is especially true during COVID, and just the fact that, like, the whole world was was like recognizing it too was just lovely. And I don't know, I just like, it just really reiterated how important my profession is. And yeah, I'm just proud to, that I get to do it every day. Proud and blessed that I get to do it every day.
Great. And Jacqueline.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I'm so proud therapist. I'm so proud every day when I get to work with patients so closely and see how they improve and try and get them home safely to their loved ones. And I think, you know, this whole experience has, again, really shed light on all the different important roles. So there were so many challenges that we've had to overcome and be flexible with. For example, in, I know in terms of dispositions, when we were trying to get patients back to their long-term care, their residences, it was a huge barrier. In terms of some centers were only accepting back COVID positive patients, some only COVID negative, some none at all. And the social worker had a huge role to play in kind of figuring out. And we've kind of just worked as a team. And it's really bonded everyone together. And I can say that all my colleagues at the MHC, my occupational therapist colleagues, the social work physios, dietitians that I work closely with, and the nurses and the doctors, everyone's been incredible. And it's really made me love my job, love where I work.
Mm-hmm. Great. We did actually just receive a question now from Roseanne Tom. She was asking whether any of you were actually deployed at all to any of the CHSLDs, the nursing facilities in Quebec. I guess the answer is no, but I guess you would have seen a lot of the patients come to the hospitals, correct?
Not necessarily. I haven't been redeployed, but we don't see all patients that come. A lot of patients make the decisions with their family to die in their CHSLDs. They don't all come to the hospital, unfortunately. So I haven't been able to go, unfortunately. I might, being in anesthesia, they figured I'm not going to learn much when I go there for my future profession and that I'd be more useful in the hospital as well. I don't know for the two others.
I was super lucky to spend like the two months that I was helping during COVID on the same unit, and that I didn't get transferred elsewhere, because, you know, the same is not true for other nurses. Like some, I have colleagues who, you know, were sent to one unit and then sent to the ICU setting to help, and then, you know, sent bumped a bunch of places. And also nurses on the ward that were sent to CHSLDs kind of because they had less seniority. And yeah, so I just think that I was lucky to kind of remain in the same setting and not like go into these settings that they're super unfamiliar with, and that like into these responsibilities that they were super unfamiliar with. But we actually like the last month of it, though, we did get like a majority of our patients were from CHSLDs. And obviously, like Enig said, it's not all the patients from CHSLDs that ended up coming to, or at least obviously not to my ward, it was just one ward. But yeah, there were a lot of patients from CHSLDs that were there at the end.
Mm-hmm. So we did just get another question from one of our viewers. So I think we could probably squeeze in one or two more. This is a great question, actually. It comes to us from Danielle Lapointe. She's asking, how has working with COVID patients affected how you behave outside of the hospital and precautions that you take yourself and with your families? And then the second part of her question was if you had any thoughts or feelings about the opening up of Montreal and whether it's happening too soon or too quickly. Jacqueline, you want to start maybe the beginning part of that question to start?
So I think for me, because I was working with COVID patients at the beginning of when all this started, I was telling my family to be very cautious. So for example, my grandmother plays bridge and I told her, please don't go. This is before everyone started being on isolation. So I was really reinforcing these things. But I also think just having a good understanding of how the virus spreads and what can prevent the virus from spreading has made it good in terms of, you know, if I give my grandparents groceries and I'm seeing them, what precautions I need to take without me being very stressed or nervous. So I think that's one thing that I've taken with me, all my knowledge that I've learned about COVID from everyone that I've worked with, and kind of brought it out to when I'm handling things with my family or friends.
Okay, how about you, Palmina?
Yeah, it's unfortunately definitely affected like the way I interact with my family, especially. I'm kind of still keeping my distance a little bit, even within our home, kind of, you know, unfortunately not hugging them and things. But and I think that, you know, I think that because we did, and I'm sure the same is true, obviously, for Enik and Jacqueline, like I used to care for patients with infectious diseases before as well. You know, like I've cared for patients with tuberculosis and C. difficile and other infections that can be really contagious and problematic. But I think that why COVID has especially changed the way I interact with my family is just like the newness of it and just the fact that, you know, we're not really sure how to treat it yet. We're not really sure like what immunity looks like or, so I think that's just, it definitely has affected. And I can't remember the second part of the question.
Well, it was about sort of your thoughts around the city, Montreal, opening up.
Sorry, you just wanted to ask to answer the first part, I think, first.
Well, if you want to take a shot at the second part, you can.
I mean, I think that I definitely don't have the knowledge or skill to assess whether it's too soon or not. I don't, but I do feel that like no matter when it would have happened, I think it would have felt too soon. I think even if it would happen in a month or two, it would have felt, you know, too soon. I think we would have been apprehensive no matter when it happened, so.
Okay, and Anik?
When I worked with COVID patients, I took a lot of precautions. Even though I live alone, I wanted to make sure that I wouldn't infect myself by mistake in my own apartment. So as soon as I would come home, I would get completely undressed as soon as I crossed the door, put those clothes in a bag, keep the bag at the entrance, because these would be my, just to go to and from work. Like once I'm at work, I put scrubs on, so it doesn't matter, but like I still walk in the hospital with these clothes. So as soon as I would come home, get undressed, go in the shower right away, clean myself completely, then come out of the shower and be like, okay, now I can start touching my cat or my kitchen. Like I wouldn't touch anything else before that. I don't know if it was an overkill. I don't think so. It was an overkill because I didn't know how much I was infected and I didn't get sick. I might have gotten COVID at some point, but not to my knowledge. And I think that these were not an overkill precaution to take. So that changed a lot. I still haven't really seen my family. We do a lot of FaceTime, taught my grandmother how to do a FaceTime as well, which was a whole experience. And but I haven't been really with them since this whole thing started. So I miss them. But as Pelmina was saying, I don't know. I'm not an expert in any social security, distancing or anything like this. I just try to follow what the government says and even take it a step further for everything. So even if they're like, oh, you can still come over, I'm like, nah, I'd rather not. Like, I'd rather stay home and make sure no one gets infected because of me. Because like, how bad would I feel if my grandma gets sick because of me? Like, I'd feel horrible. So I'd rather just stay away from her and make sure she's okay.
Yeah. So on that note, we actually just got one more question. Maybe I think we have time. I'll squeeze it in. And I guess this stems from, we've seen quite a few of these videos that nurses and others have put out, sort of pleading with the public to be more careful and to respect public health guidelines. So this question comes from Andrea. I'm going to have a hard time pronouncing her last name. I think it's Shayo, Andrea Shayo. She's asking, given your frontline experience, how do you feel about the behaviors of people on the outside? For example, people who don't wear masks when they're inside in crowds, etc. I'll leave it to you if any of you want to jump in on that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something that that worries me a bit, just because I'm super, like Anik was saying before, you know, when I go into my home, I do that whole disinfecting procedure. And then when I go out into the community, I'm acting with just as much caution as I am in the hospital. And I think sometimes it's easy to kind of forget that a virus is around when you're not seeing it or working with it every day, but it's so easy for it to transmit from one person to another. So definitely when I'm in grocery stores and people aren't wearing masks, I get kind of nervous because I, you know, even though things are starting to open up, I'm too kind of the mindset, especially because I'm still working with COVID patients, that I don't want to spread anything to anyone else, but it's hard to know who has it, who's been exposed to what. And so if things are going to start open up, I hope that everyone's going to kind of use those precautions of wearing a mask when you can't keep a 2-meter distance and good hand hygiene as much as all the healthcare workers have been doing.
Mm-hmm. Great. Palmina, did you want to jump in?
Yeah. I don't know if I have an opinion necessarily actually about like the people not being careful and things like that. But I think, I don't know, I think that it's been interesting actually to watch the public kind of use masks and gloves and I don't know. I think that's been good in that, like, it's made people, I think, more aware of germs and kind of how to be careful and proper hand hygiene. And but I don't know. I don't really have anything to do.
That's all right. And Anique, if you want, I can give the last word to you, our president of the medical residents of McGill.
So I'll second a bit what Jacqueline said, that it makes me a bit nervous. I gotta say, when I walk alone down the streets, I'm not gonna put my mask, but when I go into a grocery store, mask comes on. But it's mostly the hand hygiene that I've seen that people kind of half want to do. Like, they go into the grocery stores and they're like, yeah, I wash my hands. Okay, done. So that I'm like, come on, this is the most important part, is washing your hand. Like, you can at least do that. So that's the most antsy part I get from this whole thing. Right. But I understand at the same time that people just want this to get over, and like, it's summer and everything's closed and people are getting tired of this whole thing. And I 100% agree. And we live with this 24/7. So yeah, I understand that you're tired. I'm also tired of this. But it's not going anywhere. And if we continue, the second wave will happen and it's not going to be pretty.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, very well said. And I think all three of you are probably a lot more tired than any of us watching here for the incredible work that you've been doing. So I know we're just about at the top of the hour. So I think that about wraps up the time we do have for today. But thank you to all the viewers who did send in questions and the ones we were able to get to. Before we close, I would like to remind everyone that this video will be available at this very same link after our recording ends. So feel free to share it with others who are not able to tune in live. And keep watching your email and social media feeds for more opportunities to learn about how McGill is confronting the challenges of COVID-19 and keeping you informed. If you are a McGill graduate not currently receiving our emails or would like to be added to our distribution list, visit alumni.mcgill.ca/register to sign up. And of course, a huge thank you to our three guests today, Dr. Anique Bérard-Viesson, our nurse Palmina Montanaro, and occupational therapist Jacqueline Stevenson. Not only for your time today, which of course is very much appreciated, but mostly for all of your sacrifices of these past few weeks, where each of you put your own health and safety concerns aside to step up and help the sick and vulnerable in our community. I imagine there are lots of people watching right now who are feeling tremendous pride for the kinds of graduates that McGill is producing and for the contributions you're each making to society. So thank you. Finally, a couple of upcoming programming notes. McGill will be hosting its virtual convocation ceremonies tomorrow and Friday to celebrate the class of 2020. And
when your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Stand and be burned, women of whalers. sailors soon learn the meaning of worry and yearn. Women sing their songs of safe returning for their men. Let him only one day, someday, touch my hair again.
CKUT, Henry Grimes, and stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask, and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
A lua girou, traçou no céu um compasso. A lua girou, traçou no céu. Eu bem queria fazer.